how are we going to ensure, say, we were to get a socialist administration all over the world, that these troops that are not even loyal to the democratic power will actually, you know, withdraw and things like that without, you know, dragging their heels, just like their capitalist 1% will drag their feet. How are we going to know that they won't? Because the thing is, apparently, quite a few troops, I mean, in a lot of Western countries, I mean, not to mention the Eastern countries, where they're definitely responsible to the authorities, but in Western countries, they're apparently responsible to some sort of general who has got his own political ideas, irregardless whether there's this kind of government or that kind of government, the same thing still happening. I mean, that's what I would like to know.
Steve,
yeah, I'd like to say, in response to what was said there, that the troops, an army cannot have any power without the support of workers as a whole. You know, let's imagine, as is possible, that a majority of workers understand and want socialism, but the army goes along carrying out its orders, doing the dirty work, and supporting capitalism or supporting the old bosses. The fact is, and this is a tactical, this is a strategic point, an army cannot survive without industry supporting it. An army can't survive without water supplies. An army can't survive without electricity. An army can't survive without transport, petrol. An army can't survive without food. An army can't survive without clothing to wear, and if workers all around boycott that, they can't have it. And I'll give you a definite example, and this has got nothing to do with socialism. A few years ago, there was a strike in London, which I happened to be fairly closely aware of and connected with, and that was the Grunwick strike in North London, where workers went on strike. Now, this isn't an example of socialism, this is an example of what workers can do. If workers in the surrounding areas, because the strike was about the fact that an employer called George Ward would not allow a union to exist in his factory, which was developing photographs, and a number of workers who formed the union, who as it happens were Asian workers, got a sack for forming a union. And there was a big strike. The police were used to break up the pickets. In fact, the local police chief in the area of London where the strike went on was so much on the side of the employers that when he had to resign from the Metropolitan Police because of the tactics he had supported in beating out strikers, he took on the job as the chief security guard for Grunwick. So that is the extent to which he was in with them. Now, there were a number of people who said at the time that strike could have been won not in a month or a year, but in less than a week, if the postal workers refused to take their post to that factory, which incidentally, the local postal workers in Cricklewood did do, much to their credit. The electricity workers cut off their electricity. The gas workers cut off their gas. The water workers cut off their water. If people said in the local cafes around the area, we won't supply you with any food. If the bank clerks said, we won't supply you, we won't cash any checks for you, we won't deal with any of your business. Workers have got all that power. Because workers run society from top to bottom. Working class, it's a paradox. The working class is powerless in one sense, because it doesn't control and own the means of producing and distributing wealth. The workers are powerful in another sense, because the average owner of industry has never been in a factory. The average owner of a South African gold mine has never been down a gold mine. You know, he might have gone potholing on his holidays, but he's never been down a gold mine. He'd get lost if he went down a gold mine. Maybe it'd be a good thing if they did go down a gold mine and somebody paved over the top of it, but it's never happened. So the fact is, the power of the gun in Belfast, the power of the bayonet, capitalism comes from the working class. And this is something else that James Connolly said, because James Connolly said a number of interesting things. And incidentally, as one of the speakers might want to go into, James Connolly had a lot to do with the movement within the Social Democratic Federation at the turn of the century, out of which this party was founded. And Connolly supported the kind of democratic ideas which we were putting against the ones that were being put by people in the SDF who supported British imperialism and so on. But one of the points that he made was that the rich and powerful are only mighty because the workers are on their knees. I mean, that's not a quote of exactly what he said, but that's roughly what he said. And that is a fact. If workers refuse to support the army, if workers refuse to wave the flags, if workers refuse to work producing profits for the capitalist class, there is nothing they can do. They cannot force people to work for them. They cannot force people to be exploited. There's no way they can do it by the barrel of a gun. The only answer that we've got is that the army, the air force, the navy, the government, both local and national, have got to be taken into the control of the working class, used, if necessary, in order to dispossess the minority capitalist class and establish a classless society. And I defy anyone to tell me on a realistic level, because I've got as good imagination as anyone, probably better certain times of the day, that I defy you to tell me that you're going to get the royal family, or the House of Lords, or the House of Frauds, as we call them in this party, or some group of the Politburo in Russia going out to the working class and saying, sorry, you can't have socialism. We're going to stop you. We're going to prevent you from having socialism. You can imagine the Duke of Edinburgh coming out of Buckingham Palace with his hockey stick saying, if you try to take the world for yourselves, I'm going to stop you. He wouldn't stand a chance. People wouldn't even need to shoot him. You'd probably just send him over to the Falkland Islands or something for rest. I mean, someone like that would just be done. Once the working class of the world want a world for themselves, no force on earth can stop them. And if a few ignorant and loyal workers want to support one country or another, they would just be told, well, you support the capitalists. You won't get any food, you won't get any water, you won't get any electricity, and if you want to be a mug, and if you want to die for your country, well, the working class socialist majority will assist you in the process.
I'm not going to challenge.
Yeah. Can you put the question to the?
I'm not going to challenge the answer. I mean, I haven't got as much imagination and as much information as I've come. But the thing is, there won't be any problem if the workers of the world at the same time realized they wanted socialism and they worked towards it together. But I was just imagining a scenario like Poland, where almost the entirety of Poland, except the troops and the people in government and a few other people in the ordinary working population, really wanted the workers to take control. But they were crushed because the army, although they're supposed to be loyal to the rest of the country, were only loyal to the ruling authoritarian sort of establishment. And despite the fact that the workers were not producing anything which the army could have, I mean, at one time there was 10 million or something like on strike. I mean, that is quite a major disruption in this age. But then the thing is, the army quite efficiently crushed the workers, despite the fact that, I mean, the workers had really demonstrated their unity of purpose and they'd really put their strength together. So it's not... there wouldn't be a problem if there was no country, say, in the case of Poland, like Russia, that came to feed the troops in Poland. But if we're imagining of things happening at different times in different countries, I mean, this is the scenario that I'm thinking about. That's why I thought that, say, if it was happening in the case of Ireland, what guarantee have we got that the Americans or somebody, or the Canadians or the Australians wouldn't sort of ensure that these troops can stay in Ireland anyway, despite the fact that workers in Britain and in Ireland and in Scotland decided that they were not going to give them any kind of, you know, support.
I think Clifford, yes.
Yeah. Can I just say a point? I'll try to. When we talk about a socialist alternative, and we're actually sticking our necks out, we're saying we've got the answer to all of these problems. That's the first point. We're saying we've got a positive, practical answer, which is not just that, but it's urgent, extremely urgent, and therefore demands your attention in the form of literature or spoken word or whatever. But what is this alternative we're talking about? Because obviously it's incumbent upon us to actually describe it in a certain amount of structural detail so that we've got some kind of practical suggestion to make. So for the starting point, what is socialism? It's a worldwide form of society, that's the first point. One world, no national boundaries. Now obviously that takes some imagination because we're living in a world which has got national boundaries. So obviously it takes imagination. But every single change which has ever taken place in the history of mankind has had to be at least in some degree imagined by somebody and gradually brought into operation. So that's no problem, we can think about that. So you have one world with no national boundaries. And after all, they talk about a global village. I mean, the national boundaries are getting more and more irrelevant each day as it happens. So that's quite a practical starting point. One world as a productive unit. So in other words, you don't have to say, well, we try to be self-sufficient in this country or we trade with that country. Trade is finished in this socialist world. You have one world, which is one unit. So in other words, you say, right, we need to make a glass out of three ingredients. We've got them. Doesn't matter if they're in that corner of the world or that corner of the world, we as a world have got them, so we make the glass without any barriers. Therefore, you've got no passports, you've got no police forces or guards or armies, because all of these institutions quite openly exist to defend property, and of course, that's the second point, that you have no property.
Let me just correct I mean, the basis on which you answered the question. Yeah. I'm not talking about a time when we have socialism. I'm talking about a time when we're progressing towards socialism. We're not working on the assumption that we've got socialism in every country. We're grabbing the world by democratic means. Everybody has voted for it, but we still got armies. That's what I'm talking about.
But can I just say, what I was going to do, in fact, I was describing to you a socialist world just as a starting point. After that, hopefully, I want to try to say how we get from A to B. But I just wanted to make this point absolutely clear. So this socialist society, you've got free access to wealth. What does that mean? It means that all of the wealth in the world in a socialist society, by definition, must be owned collectively by every single human being on earth. And that literally means every human being. There's no distinction of race or sex. It means every single man, woman and child on the face of the earth owns the earth. Now again, for hundreds and thousands of years, that's been seen as a bit of an ideal. What we're here to say is that it's no longer an ideal. Modern advances, 1983, mean that this particular concept is no longer just an ideal, it's practical, it can be done and it must be done. That's the second point. So you've got free access and you've got one world. Next point about, I'm just trying to describe socialism to you because this is incumbent upon us. Next, it means that instead of producing wealth for profit, in other words, you know, ICI come along and they say, is it profitable to produce X cars? Can we sell them? Have we got the market? In other words, have people got the cash and all the rest of it? That goes. And instead, you're simply producing people's needs. Do people want cars? If they want cars, we'll build them, because we are them, we want the cars, we build them. And the only way that can be done is by getting rid of the small minority. I don't mean getting rid physically, obviously, I mean in a social sense. Getting rid of a situation where a small minority in every country in the world has some kind of control, some kind of ownership over the resources. Because as long as that happens, they're just going to say to us, look, that's not the way we play it. You work for us. You produce the items for us because it's our machines, our factories, our government, our control. And we tell you the conditions under which you can do that, when you can do it, and when you've come and done it, if we want you to. We take these items, we put them on the market, we sell them at the highest price, and we cash it in on it. Now, that's the system we've got in every country. So the alternative, and they're not going to like this, but we are, is that the vast mass of mankind takes that those resources away from them, democratically, in the sense that there's a majority of us, so we can do it. They can't complain. Well, they can, but they're not going to get very far. It's as simple as that. Now, we've got no grudge against them. We're not going to go around killing people. We're just saying we've got to take that wealth away from them with the threat of force, if nothing else, because there's a majority of us. So that's what we mean. Now, when you ask this question about actually getting socialism, what do we do step by step? That is a very important question to ask. Now, I should just say at this point, there's a party in Ireland which is involved in producing this called the World Socialist Party of Ireland. It's one of about 20 parties in Belfast. it's very unique compared to the rest of them, because it's a companion party of the SVGB. Therefore, it stands for this world socialist concept that I've been describing. So how do we get it? Well, we've set up political parties, that's the first point. So we're not just talking airy-fairy sort of utopian talk, we've got political parties actually contesting at elections. So if we contest at an election, when we can afford to do so, what do we say? What we're saying is that, well, I won't go over this, I said it before, about the majority of people actually taking that step of taking that wealth away and running it cooperatively. Now, of course, you've got armies in every country in the world which are there to defend the status quo. And you say that they don't always obey the dictates of the people or even of the government. They have this, they're unanswerable in one sense, except to the ultimate interest of property. Now, I would say that is only half true. Generally, and I'd say generally, the army is under the control of the government. That's only a general point. In fact, I happen to have, if you could bear with me for a second, I happen to have a quote here, which is by Colonel Robert Evelyn, who was a major colonel in the Northern Ireland War, and he wrote a book called Peacekeeping in a Democratic Society, The Lessons of Northern Ireland, because they've been using that as a laboratory to try and find out a thing or two about their own system. And he tried to clarify what the role an army should have, theoretically, in a capitalist society. And he says, firstly, the constitutional position of the army must be clarified so that it comes under the power of the state executive, rather than working separately from it, as in the past. Now, what that demonstrates is that there is a tendency, at least, within capitalist world society, for armies to be, loosely speaking, under the control of the executive arm of government, because, after all, the government is basically looking after those property interests. So it's a chain of command. Now, that's not always exactly the case, but that is, broadly speaking, what happens. Now, don't forget, the army itself is composed of working class people like ourselves, straight off the dole queue. So they're just workers anyway, but that's how the army plays its role. Now, you're quite right. A socialist revolution of this kind, which involves a massive revolution in mental ideas and consciousness of people to stop accepting things the way they are, that is not going to happen simultaneously. You're not going to wake up tomorrow morning and find that X million people in each of these countries have suddenly changed their mind. It's a gradual process, and we're trying to encourage it, but it is happening because of the conditions driving people towards it. Right, but it's a gradual process, and it's happening in every country. And the point I make to you in reply to your central question about whether this can happen simultaneously or it's out of control one with the other, is that conditions in all of the major countries of the world, I mean the majority of the world, are in many ways so similar that therefore people's ideas tend to progress at a roughly even rate. I mean, I know I'm saying it's full of qualifications, but you see the point. In other words, if you go across to France now and you start arguing with workers, the kind of arguments they put to you are about the same level. There'll be the same people who'll say, well, there's always been rich and poor and all these other lies and myths. And there'll be people who'll say, you know, we've got to defend the government. And there'll be some who'll say, no, we're sick of it, we want to try something different. And if you go as far away as Australia or America or any country, you get roughly the same level of both negative conservative ideas and a certain amount of radical ideas which are looking for something different. And the reason for that is conditions are very similar, and therefore people are motivated in this similar way. So it's not going to be simultaneous, but what it can be is coordinated. And we've got companion parties in about half a dozen countries at the moment. We want to form many more. And this process can be coordinated as more and more people come to completely reject the present society based on its values of property and profit instead of on human needs. More and more people are coming to reject that. They might not all be in this party, but they're coming to reject it. There's no doubt about that. And we have to draw on that. We have to actually put these positive alternatives, this positive alternative to those people in every country we can, which is not many at the moment because we're weak in numbers. But so it's not going to be simultaneous. It doesn't have to be. But what I think you would find is that when you've got this process gradually bubbling over in all different parts of the world, what will happen almost certainly is that as the process develops, as the rate of socialist consciousness increases everywhere gradually, the movement will become more uniform. Because as the numbers grow in this part, you know, if we've only got our numbers here are still barely 1,000, under 1,000. Now, when this movement here in Britain runs into thousands of people who are completely committed conscious socialists on these terms, this definition, then of course the movement will not only become more rapid and it will snowball like anything, because this is a logical idea we're putting, which makes sense. Not only that, because we'll start to get control of media, we'll start to get control, we'll be getting people on local school boards, on the local boards which run hospitals, local district health authorities, everywhere you're going to have revolutionary socialists. This process builds up. And the more it does build up in one part of the world, the more resources we will have to spread that. You know, even, I mean, this is happening now. There are members of this party now who are travelling, who are going to different parts of the world, and they're trying to help to encourage this movement towards a better form of society from our material class point of view. So the more our resources grow, the more that's going to happen. And, you know, it really is a danger you needn't worry about to envisage one country which has a massive socialist majority and, you know, all of the other countries don't. That would be taking the hypothesis too far. There may be discrepancies. There almost certainly will be because, you know, some countries are obviously very different from others. But generally, there is this uniformity. Everywhere you go, workers working for wages, trying to pay the rent, worrying in some cases about paying mortgages, trying to work for years to save up the money to buy a car, you know, not to buy a palace or a swimming pool, but just to buy something you can get from A to B in, and you have to work for years just to get that. And that's the same experience for workers in every country. Rapidly, it's becoming more and more uniform. So that I think that is the answer in the question of coordination.
Three people I think have been waiting for some time. I think I'll take you first, and then there's a gentleman right at the back. Okay?
Well, the question I'd like to ask is, you know, I'm sort of new to this. I've never ever been to a political meeting or anything like that. But there's a couple of questions I'd like to ask in one minute. I can't remember what they are. But one of them is, like, you know, what country in the world is a purely socialist society? And I suppose the second one is, if there is a socialist society, and you were saying about you can, you know, everyone is not equal, but everyone's got enough to survive on and they can have what they want, so to speak. But, you know, I mean, who's to tell them to say what they can have? I mean, say somebody wants a house on one piece of land, you know, because everything belongs to everyone. Who tells that person, if there's two people going for it, who decides which one?
There is no country which is a socialist country. There's no country in which socialism has ever been established, although there are a lot of movements that have called themselves socialist in order to try to give themselves the gloss and the appearance of something different. There are countries aplenty now which call themselves socialist. Every new movement, every new leader who wants to persuade the perhaps less well-informed amongst his armies and his rabble to look on him as something different, as something new, will call himself a socialist. It's happened in Zimbabwe, it's happened in so many countries of the world now that it gets almost boring. Socialism could not be set up in one country precisely because socialism is a system of free access. It is a system in which every man has access to everything that the world can produce. Capitalism can't work in one country. Capitalism, being such a terribly complicated and top-heavy organisation, has to be organised on a worldwide basis, and socialism will too.
Excuse me, yeah. But that gets on to my second question. So if it was worldwide, who decides that two people have got to that plot of land? Or...
Right. Yeah. In the first place, there would be none of the heartache, none of the soul-searching that goes on now when one tries to decide how to apportion the wealth that we have. Because in socialism, all of the massive resources at our disposal now, all of the factories, all of the mines, the quarries, the brick kilns, railways and so forth, which now are wasted, put to waste, made idle, all the workers who are made unemployed, all the resources that are turned to producing things that we don't need, like weapons, all of those would be turned to producing what we do need, what we do want, like houses, like clothing and food and education, all the things that we consider to be worthwhile. In that circumstance, there would be so many houses potentially, so much wealth for people to take from that no one would have any problem in just making it where it was wanted. So the people themselves, who were in a position at last to decide what they wanted to make, how they wanted to make it, where and when they wanted to make it, would say, well, here's this bloke Bill, he's got a family, he wants a house, let's build him a house. You know, we have bricks. At the moment in this country, we have, I forget how many bricks it is, but there are vast stocks of bricks waiting there to be built into houses. There are millions of people unemployed who just love to build them into houses. There are hundreds of thousands of families who want houses to live in, and yet it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because it doesn't make profits to build houses in this country now. In socialism, all of those bricks, all of those willing workers to build them, to build houses with, and all of the unemployed would get together and say, hey, look, this doesn't make sense. You know, we've got the means, let's build the houses. Decisions will be made by people at that fundamental level. It will be made by communities working together in their own best interests. It will be made by the whole people, not by leaders. And that's how we see it coming about.
Yeah.
The speaker reminded me of Evangelist in a
sense that their answers to the questions and to the problems are always either the devil or salvation. The devil being capitalism and salvation being socialism. And we came along, I think, for to discuss the problems of Ireland and the crisis that exists in Ireland. But we were given, I feel, a fairly sketchy history of Ireland and a small analysis of what is happening in Ireland. The provisional IRA, for example, were described by one speaker as a crowd of drunkards, virtually. And another speaker made an irrelevant quote from something that was enacted by the British government in 1654, if my memory serves me right, without even referring to what Cromwell was doing in Ireland or referring to the Confederation of Kilkenny, from which oppressive legislation emanated. It's just as silly for to pick bits and pieces from European history and try and pass it on to people as fact. If you're going to deal with the history of a period, you should try and deal with it, I think, seriously and in depth. I would imagine that most of the people who came along here tonight didn't come along for to be sermonized about how the world socialist system may work in 100 years' time, or 50 years' time, or even 20 years' time. But most, I think, if they'd read what you did, the literature that you put out in advance, came along to try and discover what is happening in Ireland, and above all, what sort of solution we could apply to the problems that exist in Ireland and which beset the Irish people. Now, this wasn't done. Even when you came to the United Irishmen, you dismissed it glibly as a nationalist movement. The United Irishmen was by no means a nationalist movement. It was a movement which was bourgeois, it was democratic, it was a bourgeois democratic movement which emanated from the social conditions of the time when republics were being established in many parts of the world, particularly in France, to which the Irish were very close to at that time. And because of that, Wolfe Tone, who led the United Irishmen, tried to involve the oppressed Catholics in Ireland. The Catholics were being oppressed for very historical reasons. Now, the Protestants themselves had their problems in Ireland, and there is a tendency also amongst the two speakers to confuse the Protestant ascendancy and the Protestant working class. At least there's no attempt to make a distinction. The Protestant ascendancy who arrived in Ireland originally were planters. I don't think that was mentioned, at least it wasn't mentioned during the period I was here. And the Protestant working class and small farmers who followed them were by no means an ascendancy class. They were people who were fleeing from religious persecution in other lands, in Scotland and in England. And they today constitute the working class which exists in the north of Ireland. They are the people who live in the Shankill Road and in Sandy Row. They just have the same problems as the Catholics have in the south of Ireland in dealing with the state that they live in. What I'm leading up to, and I can't obviously take up the time of the meeting for a long time, is that there are two communities in Ireland who have classes within them, and all those classes have problems. And for to try to lump them together as one, or for to see United Ireland's or borders being removed or replaced or anything else, isn't going to solve the problem. What we have to do is not go along either and preach salvation to them in the form of socialism, but for try to understand exactly why they're being rent in two, why they're in conflict, why the Protestant working class, for example, supports the ascendancy Protestant working class, why the Catholic working class supports an ascendancy. You said, for example, very clearly in this article I read in 1981, that it was the uneven development of capitalism which led to many of the problems of Ireland. But you didn't follow it up by saying that there were many social reasons for the divisions in Ireland. There are great social divisions between the people of the north of Ireland, the Protestants, and the south of Ireland, largely the Catholics. They have different values. And because of these different values, and because of the historical forces which have torn them apart, the Catholic historical forces led by the Pope in the Middle Ages, trying to build dynasties and to build counter-reformations, and the pro-Reformation movements. These are the things which have torn them apart. These are the things which leave them today in historical conflict. And it's not just conflict between Catholics and Protestants, but rather between secularism and religion, between secularism and the values that are opposed to secularism.
And it's not just a conflict which is related to the Irish people, but rather to the people of Britain and Ireland, to all of us. And some sort of an explanation should be given to the people of God that are attempted at. Not just a long sermon about socialism and telling us that in the future, in 100 years' time, we might have world socialism, which will solve all our problems. Tell that to the man on the Shankill Road, or to the man who's boozing in a Dublin pub and who wouldn't particularly be interested in carrying a gun for the provisional IRA, despite what one of your speakers said. Thanks.
I'll try to do it. Obviously, you've raised a number of questions there, and I'll do my best to try to answer them, but the limitations of time trying to cover them all. Firstly, I think that your question, your comparison to start with, has a bit of a sting in its tail when you refer to evangelism and religion, because I hope it would have become clear by now that there's a socialist party who are running this meeting. Are implacably hostile to all religion, and I take it you're aware of that.
I think you missed my point.
Sorry?
I think you missed my point.
No, well, maybe I did, but as I say, I think that comparison's got a sting in its tail. If you're comparing us to being evangelistic, the fact is we're not trying to put forward a statement that everybody is either, what you said, the devil, evil, or very good, or whatever, which is a religious mythology, or looking at it in moral terms. It's true, we have made a very stark distinction between socialism and capitalism. It's true, we've, in your terms, imposed that upon the situation, but I think the reality of the matter is the other way around. The situation in Northern Ireland and the rest of the world is imposing itself upon us and upon me and you, and that therefore the solution to that involves making a mental analysis of the situation, which obviously involves making categories. It does involve using words like capitalism and socialism. It does involve trying to describe what you see before you. And our method of doing that is to say, what are the social relations in Northern Ireland? And we've concluded that the social relations in Ireland are those between wage labour and capital, as they are in Southern Ireland. That is the primary social relation. It doesn't mean that there aren't farmers or there aren't people who have paid a salary instead of a wage. I've conceded all of that. But generally, there is this division. That's what we call capitalism. History is only worth studying if there's going to be some purpose, some action. That's our view anyway. But in other words, we're not particularly interested in simply analysing for the sake of it, or what, I don't know, what people call art for art's sake or whatever. You might enjoy that, but that's not particularly what we're here to do. And I think that anybody seeing our posters or our adverts or our literature must realise that we're interested in doing something pretty urgent out of all of this. Now, you mentioned the fact that the history was a bit sketchy. Obviously, we apologise if it was too sketchy, but you must bear in mind that in 20 minutes, because that's how long each of us spoke for, it's not possible to give a very detailed history of Ireland for 800 years or even for 8 years. So it probably was sketchy from that point of view. And as for the quote which I made, you're right, it was 1654, about the Irish being sent off to Connaught and all the rest of it. I quoted that precisely to demonstrate what Cromwell was up to. I quoted that to demonstrate that Cromwell's army was there to dispossess the native people who were living there. That was my point. In other words, this was a battle over property. First they owned it, then the English moved in and they owned it. So I was trying to demonstrate the point that there are the fundamental conflict is to do with ownership. Of course, we have to agree with you when you say that the United Irishmen movement was bourgeois, as you put it, or capitalist. We accept that, but that doesn't stop it from being nationalist, because all nationalist movements are capitalist. Nationalism typifies capitalism. The rise of capitalism in the 19th century, that was what it was all about, the rise of national movements, whether it was Germany or France or Britain. That's what nationalism is. It is part of capitalism, because capitalism is divided into national states. Socialism isn't. You say that we failed to distinguish the Protestant ascendancy from the Protestant workers. Again, I'm sorry, but I have to disagree with you. I think that I did distinguish the two. What I was actually trying to say was that the Protestant workers in Belfast, on the whole, make the mistake of assuming that they share that other interest of Protestants who actually have power and control, prestige and property. So in other words, there is a difference between a Protestant who owns capital and one who doesn't. There is a difference between the Protestant ascendancy and a Protestant worker who lives in those slums that you mentioned. There is a difference, obviously. That was the whole point of this meeting, to show that there is a difference and that the Protestant workers are mistakenly assuming that there isn't, because to our knowledge, and there's plenty of evidence of this, the majority of Protestant workers, unfortunately, still are fundamentally supporting that kind of ideology. Then you say that the Catholics in the North have social differences in terms of the values they support from the Catholics in the South. I'm not going to argue about that. Or you say you refer to all kinds of other differences, which you may know more about than I do. But I don't think that prohibits me from stating that those differences are subsidiary, they're secondary. And the whole purpose of our existence as an organisation, the whole reason we're running this, we don't hide the fact, is to actually urge this point to people. Now, if you call that preaching and you feel that we're shoving this down your throat, fair enough. Obviously, that's your decision and this isn't compulsory. But we are doing that. We do want to urge upon people something which we see as extremely important. When you say that socialism may work in 100 years' time, we're trying to give you this. I would like to stress that we haven't once said that socialism is something for 100 years' time. That's your statement. What we've said repeatedly is that socialism is for now. We haven't said that it's actually happening now. We wish it was. But what we're saying is that if people once chose to do so, to actually take control of their own lives away from these invisible market forces, which has got them running at the moment, if they actually start producing wealth as they want to, regardless of the market forces of profit and commerce and buying and selling, they could do it immediately. There's enough resources, there's enough technology. So that's for now. Now, if it takes 10 years or 20 years or 100 years, that will only be because fellow workers such as yourself and many, many others decide not to go along with us, decide not to support this cause, not to go out every night of the week standing there like an idiot on the street corner trying to force this on people. Because it's not pleasant. It's far more pleasant if I, like you, could stay at home and simply analyse history and make criticisms of the one organisation which is trying to do something about it. But, you know, it's not enjoyable to have to stand there trying to sell things. You know, you might feel a bit of a lemon. But what I'm saying is this is what you have to do if you want to try and get something urgent across to people. And that is very much what we're trying to do, so that it isn't in 100 years' time. We're saying it could be now. And there isn't really time to argue about this, in our view, because, you know, as I said earlier, I don't want to sound alarmist, but I think it's a fair comment that in 5 years' time, that within 5 years, there could very well be a nuclear war. I think that's pretty well common sense. Within 5 years, there could very well be all kinds of famines and disasters which this kind of profit system and commercial system just doesn't know how to cope with, because it's not based on looking after human beings, it's based upon accumulating profit. That's the whole law of the system. So finally, you say we ought to try telling this to the certain workers who you see as a bit, perhaps a bit too drunk or a bit too bigoted or a bit too pro-capitalist, in your words, to support this. Now there, it's not us who are guilty of accusing the IRA of being a load of drunken louts, it's you, because you're accusing these workers of being too stupid, too drunk to understand what we're saying, and we fundamentally repudiate that suggestion. When you say we should do this, as I said, we've got a companion party in Belfast which has been trying to do that, and I don't mind telling you that they've been attacked, and I'm referring to violent physical attacks, not just verbal ones, from both sides, traditional sides in that conflict. So this life isn't easy for them, but they're trying, they're doing that nonetheless. So okay, you finish up by saying that there's a conflict between secularism and religion. Now, in that conflict, which we don't deny exists, we are obviously against religion. I'll say, I hope we've made that clear. We don't think that religious belief holds anything for us other than a continuation of the things that we've been suffering. We think that in order to solve the problems we're suffering from, we in fact have to completely reject all religion. That's the first point to make, and I would like to point out how unique that position is, unfortunately, in the world today, because most people, you know, they're either supporting the Protestants or the Catholics, or they're supporting the army or the UVF or the IRA or one of these movements. What we're saying is, no, you don't have to support one of these. You can actually say you'd like a different system of society. But, you know, it's not that black and white either, as you put it. It's not just a conflict between secularism and religion, any more than it's a conflict between abstract entities called capitalism and socialism. Obviously, the situation is more complicated than either of those suggestions would imply. What we've actually got is a whole complicated conglomeration of forces, which in the course of Irish history, I confess to you, is far, far more complicated than perhaps we would suggest by our comments earlier. Of course it's complicated. Human life is complicated when you've got millions of people living in the world together. But what you've got today, and I'll say this in conclusion, is the whole conglomeration of historical forces, myths, prejudices, hatreds, and we are sincerely and genuinely trying to put forward an alternative to that. And I think on that basis, at least, you must, in your own interests, not only listen to that, but discuss it with us. Come again to future meetings. Read the literature. And we're open to any other points you may raise.
I feel it's incumbent upon me as a member of the party and also someone who has lived in Northern Ireland for many years to make some sort of a comment this evening. I'd like to perhaps say a few words to our friend at the rear. He seems to feel that the circumstances in Northern Ireland are very special, and so special that it cannot be equivalent to anything else anywhere else in the world. The one observation I would make, a related observation, is that most of the people in Northern Ireland are very frustrated. They're very angry about the circumstances and the social conditions in which they live. And as a consequence, they're trying to fight back in some way. the workers, they're out there killing each other, they're out destroying buildings, they're out destroying property, they're fighting against something. There are many of them that are living in slum conditions, as Clifford quite correctly pointed out. Perhaps 1 in 7 houses are classified as slum. It's not really different to any conditions that are suffered by workers in the south of Ireland or any other part of the world. It's a sort of common problem, so I don't think the circumstances are that special. That's really the main point I would like to make, that they're all fighting against something, but that unfortunately they're misdirected. And I think if they could perhaps realise that it's in no one's interest to go out and kill each other and destroy property for nothing more than nationalism, then, you know, I think that's really the only point I'd like to make.
Well, Chairman, if that's the only point he wants to make, I'd like to make just a small point. I was born and reared in Northern Ireland, and I'm well acquainted with conditions in Northern Ireland just as much as you are. And I think that the circumstances are very special. They're not the same as the circumstances that workers live in the rest of the UK, in a sense that the majority of the people in Northern Ireland at the present time are in great danger of a civil war breaking out. And that doesn't exist in Northampton or in Scotland or in Wales. That's the special circumstances. And those are the reasons why we should be seriously analysing the problems of Northern Ireland. They're not skirting around it and shouting out a few slogans after we've referred to bits and pieces of history. But getting down to the real problems of the people of Northern Ireland who are in great danger.
I think everyone in the UK is in great danger from doing their work for us.
Ian, can you?
You've said quite a lot, friend, about historical forces. What you seem to have overlooked is that historical forces can be simplified to a very considerable degree, that what they boil down to, in the case of every war that has been fought, in the case of every cause that has been followed up by any person anywhere in the world, what they boil down to is the struggle for wealth, for resources, for the means to live in a situation of scarcity. All the leaders, the popes, the kings, the religious demigods, all of them had one thing in common, namely that they wanted to use ordinary people to secure for them the riches and the wealth that they could not have automatically, they could not have without force of arms, because there simply wasn't enough of it to go around. That situation is now changing. So we now have, for the first time, the possibility of abolishing war and abolishing the struggles that we all have been discussing tonight by creating wealth for all. To go in, as Cliff has said, to go into a long rigmarole and a long analysis of the specific nature of the historical forces of which you speak would be for us a complete and utter waste of time. We are not professional historians, for most of us. We are people who want to do away with all of the popes and the kings and the wars that form Ireland's history. And indeed form the history of countries all over the world. Ireland is not, in fact, special in having civil war at its doorstep. Civil war is now being waged in dozens of countries the world over. And many more people are dying in civil wars in some countries of the Middle East than are dying now in Ireland. And the essential point is that the preconditions of war everywhere, at every stage in man's history, can be simplified, can be analysed. The popes can be put into the corner where they belong, and working people can begin to fashion the world in the way that they want, in the way that they can control it, and to bring about the eventual end of war. That's all that we're here for. I'm sorry if you feel that we're sermonizing you. As Cliff said, you came to the wrong place if you didn't think that we would sermonize you. We're out for one thing only, and that is to spread the socialist message. We're not, as I've said, historians. We are socialists.
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Do you believe in one state socialism under any circumstances?
Do I believe in it?
Yes.
I don't see how it could possibly come about.
No.
I mean, I really don't. If there were such a thing as one-state socialism, I think it must be an awful lot better than capitalism. But by its very nature, socialism has to be a society of free access for all. And I can't believe that there could be a society where each man was able to claim for himself all the cars, all the houses, all the bread, all the food, all the clothing, all the education and entertainment that he wanted and that he needed to build himself up. And all around him, there were people slaving away to maintain the profit and the privilege of just a few. I can't understand how it could possibly come about. Apart from anything else, there would be a limitation of resources within that one privileged nation, so that before long it would run out of resources. And then, of course, you'd have your capitalist empires and and states outside with their armies and their police forces and their highly organized system of oppression pouring in to this
one
black sheep and making sure that that disease didn't spread. Socialism has to be a movement of all the working people to secure for themselves a world in which they can live without oppression, without pressure from outside. That is the only way that I can understand it.
Right, well, the time is getting on, so I'm going to ask for just one more question, and then I'm going to ask both speakers to wind up. Yes?
I haven't you forgot something. When the Irish Church, this establishment, got out, you got a different food. In here, you generally had the two kinds of Protestantism. First is Catholicism. In Northern Ireland, unfortunately, you had the established church then, which was the Church of England, but other and different in doctrine, which they say they don't, but they do in some ways. But mainly, the Protestant ascendancy was to the aristocracy and the Church of Ireland, which is, was established then. And the others don't have the episcopacy in their churches, and mostly Catholics in Northern Ireland were of the lower working class. And if you look at Ian Paisley's this unionism to Lord Butler's unionism, you'll find a complete different idea. One's totally Presbyterian in origin, but one's got a lot of Anglicans in it. So there's a great deal of difference now on the Protestant side.
I just would like to say I don't honestly see how that makes a difference from where we stand. I mean, if you're a working man, if you're a man who has to sell himself for every hour between 9 and 5 every day in order to live, if you're a man who has to effectively sell himself into slavery and to fight battles on behalf of your employer whenever he thinks fit, then it doesn't make a heap of a difference whether your employer, your lord, your master, your government follows one particular kind of unionism or another kind of unionism, whether he's religious or not, whether he's Catholic or Protestant or what he is. I don't honestly see that that makes an awful lot of difference, and that's the point that I was making essentially about the finer details of history. Although it's important and it's interesting to appreciate what went on, it's not important in the socialist analysis to get the details that fine.
I just would like to ask one question, but unfortunately the person I would like to ask it to is gone, but I still think it should be asked. I would like to ask, you know, what is the simple solution, or the complicated solution for that matter? You know, because we've got all night, if need be. I'll stay here till 2 a.m. to hear it. What is the solution? I mean, people come along and say, you socialists, you want to abolish world hunger. After all, 30 million people die of starvation every year. Well, you know, you want to produce food for everyone. Well, that's all right for 100 years' time. There's always 100 years' time. I don't know why they think it's 100 years' time, because on a safe reckoning, they reckon they'll be dead by then. So, because they think it's not going to happen in their lifetime. They think it's going to have to be some superior beings popping out the wombs of future generations who are going to produce this socialism. But, you know, they say, you can't have food for everyone. You've got to have a short-term solution. Or, well, yeah, how many people are there in Britain now? 60,000 officially homeless families. Well, you can't give them all a house to live in. I mean, we know that, you know, there are people, there's a brick surplus and there are thousands of unemployed building workers. You couldn't give them a house to live in. That'll come in 100 years' time. That's utopia. We've got to do something now, like, you know, build sort of council flats with, what you know... This sort of thing. I mean, that bloke over there said people are fighting over houses, you know. No one in their right mind would fight over some of the housing in this district. You know, you want to go down to Barnsbury Estate, see people fighting over houses. They're fighting to get out of bloody place. And then people say, oh, well, you know, last December, 10,000 old people in Britain apparently died of hypothermia. Died of the cold. People say, oh, well, you know, in 100 years' time, you're going to have this utopia, you know, this visionary ideal where people can actually not die of the cold. Switch on the heater. Well, yeah, that's out of the question. What? Not in my lifetime, you know. Oh, yeah, we're going to get a united Ireland, you know. We're going to get a Labour government producing full employment. We're going to get, you know, the Iran-Iraq war being settled. We're going to get disarmament because Mrs. Thatcher's going to sort of suddenly get a pang of morality and think, oh yeah, I better disarm, and Reagan and Andropov are going to shake hands and make it all up. Oh, this is going to happen. This isn't utopian. This is all realistic. This is the here and now, the bread and butter. This is the reality. It's a con trick. It's not true at all. When you ask these people, you know, they say, oh, well, I came along. I wanted to hear practical answers. Yeah, what practical answers exactly did he mean? You know, move the map, move the border an inch up there, move it down there, change the colour of the uniforms, you know, change a few of the values, get rid of the bishops in the Catholic Church and appoint different bishops. That's not the answer. The answer is simple. People are afraid of simple answers, perhaps. The answer is simple. The answer is straightforward. And in a sense, a comparison with Christianity is correct, because the early Christians, who were in fact just a group of proletarians who were revolting against the rule of the Roman Empire, the early Christians, all they said, you know, if you read the Sermon on the Mount, which if the Archbishop of Canterbury or the Pope ever read the Sermon on the Mount, they'd have a stroke. But if you read it, all it says is, look, have the world in common. Well, of course, at the time of the Roman Empire, that was a utopia. You probably had Romans walking around saying, oh, well, not in my lifetime. Sitting at the back of meetings, you know, when Jesus Christ was addressing some meeting, standing there on the cross, sort of saying, look, world for the workers. There's probably some bloke like him sitting at the back saying, oh no, it won't come, you know, come back later on. Well, it is later on. I mean, how long have we got to wait? I'm probably going to be here in 100 years' time because I'm taking these tablets. So I'm going to be here to prove you wrong. We can get socialism in about 5 years' time, not 100 years' time. In fact, 5 years is too long for me. 5 years is too long to wait for it. And I'm not an evangelist or a missionary or something like that. I'm an ordinary thinking person with a brain who isn't taken in by the crap which tells me that there've got to be complicated, detailed answers given by experts and politicians to things which are basic problems. You want food to eat? We can produce it. Do it. We want houses to live in, we can produce them, live in them. We want cars to drive in, if we do, produce them, drive in them. We want a world without nuclear bombs, get rid of the bloody things. We don't need them. We haven't got nuclear bombs. That isn't evangelical. That is sense. Someone comes along and says, not for 100 years' time. Well, I'm going to go along to him in 100 years' time, even if I have to visit him at a grave. And I'm going to say, it's happened, mate. You were wrong. Society has changed.